Hello and welcome to another interview for my blog and podcast, A Rich Comic Life. My name is Richard Gill and my blog describes my experiences of watching well over 1,000 comedians for nearly 50 years. My guest today is the wonderful Peter Graham. Yeah. Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm all right. Sound of one seal clapping. That's always good, isn't it?
Good to see you. You all right?
I am, yes. I've had a bit of a rough ride in the last year with health, but I'm back up and running. So
good. I'm ever so pleased. Good. I really am, because I know I've been aware of it on social media, and I felt very sorry for you. So as long as you're okay, that's
yeah. No, it's a lot better than could have been expected, and it's good ruined my wife's plans.
Of course. Anyway. Thank you so much for being a guest on my podcast. And the first question I've got for you is, how did you become a comedy promoter in the first place?
Yeah, not by design at all, really. My background, my father's a musician.
Yeah.
My mother's was a dancer. And funny enough, they met doing the Benny Hill show long before Benny Hill was a television comedian.
Wow.
And I grew up, you know, backstage of theatres and television studios. And
oh, fantastic.
My mother is Noel Gordon, or was Noel Gordon. So I sort of have a bit of pedigree with around, well, what in those days were variety acts, I suppose.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of those people were, you know, I've met through my father. And then I ended up, you know, working professionally as a musician from the age of 14 and within, you know, show business. And I went to what was then Middlesex Poly, and one of my tutors was Hugh Thomas, who, I mean, this sort of covers the inception of the club, really. He had been doing quite a bit on the folk circuit as a musician, but also doing the, like Mike Harding and all those people and Billy Connolly, increasing amounts of chat and stuff between the songs. And then he'd got involved by having a few goes at the Comedy Store, as was, in the late 70s and early 80s. And, I mean, he sold a routine to Alexi. That's another story. Wow. As well, which is very funny, because people used to complain that Hugh had nicked this routine, whereas, in fact, it was the other way around, you know. So he'd done the Comedy Store and enjoyed the whole sort of nascent scene of the early days of what we now call stand-up comedy, but then was alternative cabaret and alternative comedy.
Yeah.
But wanted to find a venue that could be a bit more sort of supportive and less bear pity, you know, so not so much of a trial and being gonged off, and rather an environment where you could be welcomed and you could feel safer, let's put it that way. So he's a very, very good front man and compere and performer and a charming guy. You probably know him. But terrible organiser. I mean, so by the time we got to the interval of his, well, he by the time he got to the interval of his first show, he realised, you know, he needed somebody to sort of press buttons and organize things, and I was one of his students, so he asked me to do that, and that's what I did. We just helped on the practical side and sold it, and, you know, ran the PA, and in fact, you know, I used to pack up the PA on a Friday and take it down to Ivor's club at the Red Rose and run the sound for him. You know, it was just a small scene.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. What a wonderful career, because when you mentioned Benny Hill at the start, I'll start with your answer. There is a section in my blog called The Ones That Got Away, and he was one of them. I've seen lots of plays about him and read his biography, but I never got to see him live. I bet he was something else live, because
I mean, I never saw him live. Obviously, I was too young, really. Or yeah. If I did, I don't remember it. But prior to his TV career, he was doing sort of solo sketches and monologues, which, you know, became things like the fastest milkman in the West, the songs. But terrible with could not come off script, would not be able to deal with an audience, any heckle or anything like that. So Glasgow Empire was off the menu.
Yeah.
But a very shy man. I remember meeting him before, not long before he died, and he had a flat just near Hyde Park, and he lived there on his own and had two huge television screens and tons of videos of varying types of entertainment, let's put it that way. But I think he was very shy with women, which is interesting, as given the all the sort of output that he did, which the Americans love.
The first ever comedian I ever saw live was 1977 on family holiday, and it was Les Dawson, and he was incredible at Scarborough. And then a year later, we saw Tommy Cooper, and I got the bug for it. And
well, I was working with Tommy Cooper the night before he died.
Oh, mate! Oh,
and or maybe two or three nights before, he was doing a warm up for that show at Her Majesty's.
Yeah,
and he collapsed that night as well.
Oh dear!
And his doctor was his son was there, and his other half, let's put it that way, at the time, and they were saying, Tommy, don't do Sunday night. You know, you're not well. And he said, I have to. You know, I have to do it. You know, he says, what's that thing he said? You know, it's not the principle, it's the money.
When we saw him, the curtains opened and there was nothing on stage but a bed, and he was lying on it, and this one woman died with laughter, and it just trickled round, and he hadn't done a thing, and he popped his head up perfect timing, and he just went, what, has somebody come on?
Well, he famously did all those intros off stage.
Yeah.
You know, and also there's a line I use, and I don't know whether I heard it or whether I came up with it. There's no middle ground with Tommy Cooper. Nobody says he's all right. You either love him or you don't get him at all.
And
it's always a sort of a marker for me. If somebody says, no, don't like him, then I think, you're not my type.
Too right, my friend. I totally agree. There is a level, there's another level where there is the hat, or there's the twiddle of the glasses that Eric Morgan had. They would walk on and not do anything and would be hilarious. The reason why my blog exists is because of Morecambe and Wise. They were the earliest memory I had of the entire family watching them and crying with laughter at both of them. One needed the other.
But this, it's really interesting that, because they worked from childhood together, and those, that ability to get a laugh with that or from whatever was from 35, 40 years of experience. And this is one of the things I tell younger comics who think they've cracked it after three good gigs where they weren't, you know, booed off, and they say, I've done it now. I tell them the story. I remember Ernie Wise coming round to our house once in the summer. It was a nice sunny day. He'd come round just to have a tea or something, I think, because he was living in Maidenhead then. I grew up in Oxfordshire. And my dad said to him, how are you doing? He said, they'd done a show the night before. And he said, oh, Christ, we did Sheffield last night, died to death. And that was during the time when they were getting 20 million every weekend. And they still, you know, you still get a bad gig.
It's this ability to perform and wanting to be better every time you go on.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's sadly what killed Eric Morecambe, because he was always going for the laugh. He had the heart problems and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But he would famously always try and better himself, because each Christmas, certainly, and Eddie Braben, the writer, would get so stressed out trying to top the last show. Yeah. It was an extraordinary legacy that they've left behind. But
Johnny Ammons, you know, the producer who was with them for so many years, you know, he said the reason it was the same thing. They were always trying to do the best they possibly could, and they rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, you know. And I think some of their guests were surprised at how hard they worked, you know, thinking they'd just come in and do a few funny gags and get off, and realizing they're in the rehearsal studio for 4 hours, you know.
Extraordinary. So there you are promoting clubs and whatnot. How did Downstairs at the King's Head start? Because
well, that was what it was Hugh put a show on there. He'd found this room in Crouch End to do, you know, found the room that he thought would work well as a sort of jazz dive, a bit smoky and, a you know, feeling a bit dodgy. And realised, so we just did occasional shows from sort of 81, 82. And then in 83, we started doing things regularly on a Sunday. And then we started to build up stuff. And in 1985 or 86, the brewery, partly because they realised that they had something on their hands there and we were running it well, agreed to jig the room, and we had a big refurbishment.
Yeah.
At which point they agreed with me that I could sort of program and use the room 7 days a week, which at that point I was putting a lot of jazz and other stuff in. The comedy was running three nights a week, really. Our big night was Sundays. That's when we started.
Yeah.
And then it just developed from there, really.
What sort of other year stuff. Was this?
Say again, sorry?
Sorry. What sort of year was this that it started?
Well, that's why I say it's all a bit misty. I mean, and we think, we sort of now think we really started properly regularly in 83, doing stuff on a weekly basis.
Sure.
Even though we'd done occasional things in the 2 years prior to that.
Yeah.
So in a way, this is our 40th year, sort of. But then, you know, we had COVID, so I don't count those in the same way I don't count them to my age. I've taken 2 years off my age. And it's
amazing.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And I'm saying this without any humility at all. It's the same as the Morecambe and Wise thing. You always try and keep the standards up. And it's not about money, you know.
Yeah.
And even though we've all made some out of it, you know. Anybody will tell you nobody does that gig for money, you know.
Well, I first came down to London in about 1988, and my brother was here before me, and I would go and stay with him in Stoke Newington. And one of the first comedy clubs I ever went to was Downstairs at the King's Head.
And I
keep going back there whenever I can. I now live south of the river. I've lived in Southfields for a good 10 years. But I went back about 2 or 3 years ago for a couple of Edinburgh previews, and the standard was extraordinary. It was Ed Byrne, it was Perry Marks, and it was Arthur Smith. And the three of them were phenomenal. It was packed out. It's a wonderful club, and I've got so many great memories there. Congratulations again.
Well, thank you. At time of recording of this, Joe Bohr has just made a sort of feature-length documentary about the history of the club, and I do recommend seeking that out. It's probably going to be streamed for free at some point, but he'll try and make a few bob out of it first.
That's brilliant. I have read about that, and I was going to ask you about that. How did that come about?
Well, Joe asked me if he could do it, and I think he was initially just looking at doing sort of a 11 minute, 15 minute thing, and he was doing talking headshots with performers who've been there and people sharing stories, and you realise what a footprint we have.
Yeah.
You know, down in
very
terms
much
of
so.
as a point that you move through on your way up, and then you come back twice on your way down.
Yes. one of the wonderful things about my blog I think it's very unique because nobody can be bothered to write about their experiences of watching comedians. But what it also is it lists every single venue I've seen an act in, and it's wonderful watching them develop.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite stories was when I first saw Harry Hill, and he was downstairs at the King's Head. This was 30 years ago. And he brushed past me and he jumped up onto the stage and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really sorry I'm late. I had to have a testicle brought down." And he got a laugh, and then he said, "From Derby," and got a bigger laugh. And when I met him about 2 years ago, I mentioned this story and he went, "Yes, Rich." He said, "I still use that routine to this day." And the wonderful thing about him is that he's done everything. He's been on TV, he's played the arenas, and he's back in the clubs, which is lovely to see.
Did you see him when he was Boutros Ghali?
Yeah. Just fantastic. Absolutely wonderful. But
did you know the thing about the shirt as well? The big collars is that you could see what he was. I mean, I watched him over and over again on the Thursdays. We do this tryout night on the Thursdays. You could see he was trying to get something with the non sequiturs and the sort of sentences that came from nowhere. And it was the same with Eddie Izzard. You could see there was something there and they had to find it. And Harry found it when he got the suit.
Yeah.
You know, and when he got the collar.
Unique thing. And then
he knew that then informed the Harry Hill character.
Mm.
And it is a character. Harry Hill is a character.
Yeah, of course. Another great memory is a friend of mine who never really laughs. We very early on, we went to see at Downstairs King's Head, Jeff Green. God bless him. I know he's gone to Australia now, but he was phenomenally funny. And I've never seen my friend literally cry with laughter at some of his routines. And that's the magic, I'm guessing, of running a comedy club. Because every act that you book, you must be looking for originality, or they've got to be funny, or whatever it is. That whatever you do, you seem to have amazing bills, which, as you say, keeping the high standards, it's wonderful to go and watch.
Yeah, but that's, listen, this is something, this is, I rarely talk about this, so I'm going to say it now, and you can have the first chops on this. It's about curating.
Right.
And it's what few people do now, because you may have heard my sort of old fashionedness about preferring to do the booking by phone. And that's because I haven't done what a lot of people do now, is we just put a load of dates out on the internet. People fill in the gaps. That's not curation. That's just somebody saying there are three slots to be had on this night. I think about the bills, and even though it might be, you know, three men in their 40s, they'll all be three very different styles. You have to think about what you're putting out there, and I'm very careful with the compares. You talk about the big laughs in that room. The room, although it sort of, it works in spite of itself, but the one big thing of it is a low ceiling, which always helps comedy clubs. So a big laugh is always going to be amplified in there. But it's also the fact that most acts that you will see there will have, before they've got paid work there, will have spent three, maybe four times on that carpet of broken dreams. And they will be comfortable. And I don't move people on until I feel that they can enjoy their 20 minutes. And the audiences can feel comfortable and I can feel comfortable and everybody has a good time. I'm careful who I have on the door. You know, everything goes to and careful who I have comparing. Everything goes, some thought goes into it, you know.
Find
all the good clubs are the same.
But very much so. I've very recently, this podcast's being recorded in February 23. I recently went to the Stand-Up Comedy Archive at the University of Kent.
God, you are dull.
where you've submitted some amazing material, because I had a look at it. You must have some great memories of comedians appearing at downstairs at the King's Head over the years. Oh, you must have some extraordinary memories.
Of course. I mean, if I could remember. But yes, of course. And no doubt you will, like a lot of interviewers, ask me who my favourites are, which is, you know, it's a difficult question to answer. But yes, I can remember all sorts of funny things happening. And some things that come up recently at the film, you know, people have been talking about. I mean, I remember with watching another name that you will know, but a lot of people won't remember, is Kevin McAleer.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Oh, you know, long after he'd gone back to Ireland, and not that long ago, probably 10 years ago, he came and did a warm-up for something. I don't know whether it was a one-off or whatever, because he lives in Donegal or Antrim somewhere. And Stuart Lee insisted on supporting him because he's a great fan. And we watched as Kevin just stood static at a mic for telling this really complicated story, which was just like a short story, for about 35, 40 minutes. And occasionally he'd turn to one side and occasionally he'd turn the other way. And it wasn't going anywhere. It just seemed like a novella. And then suddenly he said something that brought five, six elements together in a biggest laugh you've ever heard that lasted for about 45 seconds. And I lost Stuart. I'd lost where he was. And he was on the ground. And he couldn't get up because it was so beautifully constructed. And Stuart's such a, you know, a lover of proper comedic construction, you know. It was one of those moments. And then I've seen the other side of that with Andrew Bailey.
Yeah.
Where I've seen a room on the floor hurting from laughter, about 70 people on the floor not being able to get up, and people going, stop, you know, this is hurting. And it was almost frightening. I watched this with Hugh and we talked about it afterwards. We thought, you know, this is how political movements start.
Yes, yes.
But
exactly.
I mean, it was frightening to see the hysteria in that room.
Yeah.
And it always makes me curious, is because that is the holy grail for a comic, is to have a hysterical room.
Yeah.
And if you ever see a proper hysterical room, that's frightening. I mean, it really was. It was
that's extraordinary. I'm currently reading Stuart Lee's book about being a stand-up comedian. And what is fascinating in the book is, like Kevin McAleer's another one, there are a group of comedians who just seem to take a word or take a sentence and can run and run and run. And it's like an analysis of that sentence. And it's like you keep adding a funny line to the routine and I can't laugh anymore at this. And the delivery is perfect. And it's so true what you were saying. And he's such a, he's such a great deliverer of a joke, Stuart Lee and Kevin McNutt.
But Kevin had already sort of aced that.
Yeah.
With his owl slideshow.
Yeah.
Because that, yes, he would just come out with a pointer.
I love the bizarre.
And he'd just show a picture. He'd have a picture, a slide of an owl would come up. And he'd just show it. And then he'd get the next slide up and he'd show that. And the house would fall apart. He didn't say anything. Just showed pictures of owls.
Another wonderful thing I like about about the club is that there are so many comedians who reach a certain level from me watching them, and I'm thinking of people like Boothby Graffo, who should be a lot better, a lot more popular than they are, but that they've either realized that this is as good as it's going to be, or this is as far as I want to go, and therefore they will consistently headline somewhere like the King's Head. And that's fascinating, because if they're on a bill, certainly if I'm looking through all the listings and everything, if somebody like him is on, I know I'm going to have a good time. But he always comes from left field, and I love that. Yeah. I love that in a comedian. It's not just standing up and telling jokes. You know, there's something bizarre. Well, Stuart
he's
Lee.
Multi-skilled, Booth.
Oh, it's
I mean, the other thing with Booth,
fun.
he's a good example, and that you could say this to a lot of people's careers, is that he, you know, there was a period where he was being feted and had a thing happening in the States.
Yeah.
So he sort of went out to become successful abroad, comes back, and he's lost the knowledge. You know, there's people. You get a ride. You know, if you're, you can either ride it and the agents push you through it the same, or you can stay at a level, even
Yeah.
though you are a great, you know, an absolutely bankable act. You know, and I would more often than not book a bankable act because I know that they will contribute to the evening. My audiences are going to enjoy them, even though they don't never heard of the name. And
Yeah, fascinating. Boothby's done this podcast, very kindly done this podcast, and he was one of the first to do it. And what I love about him is his couldn't care less attitude. And when we first started recording, we were all getting ready for it. He had his camera, he's walking through his house, say hello to the wife, say hello to the dog, say hello to the kids, and just sat down and just went, right, what is this? No planning at all. And we were away. We had a wonderful chat. He's a great man. There's so many, though, that have graced your comedy club of the years. They really have.
I've just realised, just by fidgeting just now, that I'd like to say those are my wife's pants, but they're probably not behind me. I've just realised.
Thank you. That's fine.
As
whatever.
Boothby, I hadn't realised. Haven't thought this through.
As long as you're okay with it, that's fine. You mentioned before about doing telephone bookings for comedians, which I think is wonderful.
There's another reason for that.
Which might
feed into your question. It is that it's 9 to 11 weekday mornings.
Yeah.
And a load of people say, what? I don't get up till 12. And I say, well, you know, if you want to do better in this business, you're going to have to be up and you're going to be writing and you're going to be working. It's just a hobby if you want to do it. You know, so many people have sort of come back to me afterwards and said, you're right, you know. There's that point where you say, this is serious now.
Yeah, it's a career, or could be a career for them. Just following on from that, do you have any ways of promoting the club downstairs, the King's Head? Do you put posters up? Do you put adverts in the papers or anything like that?
We have one flyer, which we've used since 1982, which is just passed around.
You're not kidding, are you?
No, I know. I mean, it's changed. You know, originally, yes, you'd have flyers. You'd be, you know, I mean, even, not that I could say we ever did it, you know, fly posting, things like that. And now it's, you know, it's, there's all sorts of social media. There's very little point, even though it's the preeminent thing now, of us doing something like TikTok, because it's, you know, what we would be using that four would be not visual unless I jump up and down saying who's on.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's word of mouth. That's the bottom line. Because longevity will give you that if you keep the standard up. But as having said that, I make sure all the listings go into wherever they should be. I make sure that all our websites are up to date, up to the minute, you know, the moment somebody pulls out. I mean, I've got a piece of software that the moment anything changes in my diary, it's updated on the website. So that happens within seconds, you know.
That's brilliant.
Which means that all our information is always up to the minute. You know who you're going to see. You know?
Whenever I've gone, I've always had a wonderful night. I've always thoroughly enjoyed.
We've asked you to leave so many times, Richard.
Well, I'm moving on to this question, because how do you cope with any difficult audiences? If you get...
It's rare. It's rare. And I tell you why, because I have regular and long suffering, let's put it that way, door staff.
Right.
Who learn very quickly how to spot trouble coming down the stairs.
Right.
So we can normally stop it at the door before they're in.
Yeah, yeah.
If there is a problem, I tend to use now almost exclusively female staff.
Right.
Which, given that most of the time, most of the current problems are from women.
Right.
Who've had a few too many Proseccos that they're not used to. And they're not young either, usually middle-aged, and they can be very loath to leave, let's put it that way. And
whenever,
it's much easier for me to have female staff deal with that than me, for obvious reasons. Partly because I'm totally irresponsible.
I doubt that.
we don't tend to get problems. And the moment I have to use this, I will stop doing it. Never had to use security.
Right.
Never had to have any security on the door. Right. Something we can do. I've had knives pulled on me, and I've had some pretty nasty situations.
Right.
But
yeah.
that's, you know, used to be par for the course. It's less so now. You know?
I think whenever I go, because I've got this loud laugh and I have this enthusiasm and passion for it, we're not there to hear the members of the audience heckle. We're here to hear the comedians. But it's very rare nowadays that the heckles take place. But there was one infamous one where I was in the crowd where it was at Headliners, and it was Ricky Grover, and he was on stage and he was doing his routine, and there was a really drunk and not very pleasant member of the audience, and he stopped his act, jumped down, threw him out, and then came back on to the Rocky theme because he used to be a boxer, and the whole place was and he just uplifted his comedy. It was inspired.
Well, yeah,
I've never forgotten that.
But that, you know, those people who think it's about them can ruin a night.
Exactly.
I mean, in a small venue like ours,
there's
a lot of self-policing going on with audience members shushing.
Sure.
And if people don't take notice of that, then you know they're a problem, and you just have to get them out. You know. I have a trick, which is because people are mostly drunk or on something. So I use a bamboozling technique, which is I will say you can either leave with your money or without it. And they go, because they're drunk, they go, oh, I'll have my money. So at which point you've made a contract. You give them their 7 quid back and you tell them to off.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right.
And they don't think of the third option, which is to stay. You know,
that's inspired. What ambitions do you have, if any, as a promoter? Do you have any more ambitions?
Not really. I don't intend retiring as such. Important night for me at the King's Head is the Thursday nights, where we see 14 or so acts doing 5 minutes. And that is how we don't stagnate. We just move people up into the regular shows, the paid shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's an important platform to develop your own act. And I still get, that still interests me to watch people, you know, getting better.
Very few people
offer that chance now, because you there's a whole sort of circuit of playing to each other, you know, in new material and tryout nights around the country, but very little chance of progression. And people like Don and whatever will watch you at the store and move you up when you feel you're ready. And all good clubs should do that as well. It's interesting, you know, this circuit sort of reflects the American circuit, but 15 years behind.
Yes. Yeah.
So we are now getting to that stage where 15 years ago, the American circuit was starting to just have those gigs where just people acts play to each other. And you just think, what's the point in this? You know, nobody's laughing. It's just hate in that room. And I think it's a different thing if you have your own club and you want to compare it and develop your own material and learn the trade by running a gig that audiences like. But there's so many gigs that are sort of, nepotistic, really. It's just for each other rather than for anything outside of it.
Yes, I agree with that. I've been to many a night where it's a new comedy night, and friends of mine who wanted to be comedians have got up and done 5 minutes, and they've had to take a friend. The rule was that you take a friend. So I would go along and I would laugh in all the right places because I've heard the routine so many times. And then they'd think, oh my God, that's daunting, and either not do it again or keep doing it. And a few of them have come through. But I can just seem to tell, having watched so many over the years, you know.
Here's another bit of advice. If you're a comic, don't go to Bringer Nights. You know, I mean, because you won't learn anything.
No.
And they often ask me, is it a Bringer Night? Saying, absolutely not. Don't bring any friends.
Yeah.
Because you won't learn anything.
Yeah.
They'll tell you you're good when you're not. And,
exactly.
You know, this is the only way to find out is doing your material to strangers.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Very good advice. To date, what has been your comedy highlight? Have you got one?
No, not really. I mean, the only thing that I think I can say with great pride to a lot of people, and they'll have heard me say it repeatedly, no doubt, is that through Ronnie Golden and a few others, I've got to know Barry Cryer quite well. And funny enough, of course, I'd met him when I was younger. I'd forgotten about all this, you know, from a different lifetime, as it were. But so I think what makes me proud sitting in my little booth in the King's Head and whatever, is that when Barry was writing new material, he would ring me up to check if anybody was doing these jokes.
Wow.
Because he knows that I have a good memory for all jokes. You know, I know, if I smell anybody doing anybody else's material, I know it. You know, it might not remember who exactly the material was, but I know it's not theirs.
Yeah.
So Barry would often ring me and say, is anybody doing anything on baby pigeons? You know,
that's fantastic.
Or whatever. And obviously, you know, we'd share a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
Because as a musician, you know, one of the, it's an old adage that, you know, if you're on the boats or in the theatres, as a comic, if you could make the band laugh, you were doing well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, musicians do have a good memory for good jokes, I think. So
that is wonderful, because Kevin Day, a comedian, did one of these podcasts for me, and we got on to chatting about Barry Cryer. And he said, well, he said, get him on your blog. He said, I said, well, it would be amazing. And I did. He gave me his telephone number. I had to ring him. And he went, hello, is that Richard? I'm like, hello, is that Mr. Cryer? He said, yes, I'm just reading your blog at the moment. It's fantastic. It's really good. And they set it all up, and the son was there with all the working out all the computer and just left him sitting there. And God bless him, I got an hour out of him. He was just phenomenal for the people who he's written for.
Yeah.
And then after it, I had a very nice message from the son, sadly, when he passed on, saying I was probably the last person to interview him about his comedy career, which is just incredible.
Yeah. Well, his last gig was due to be in my village hall.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he rang me up and said, I think I'll be all right for it. And I could hear he wasn't well.
Right.
And, yeah,
very, very
extremely generous man and generous to the next generation when a lot of his colleagues were very dismissive and bitter that they'd lost the Saturday night slots. But he said, listen, it's each generation finds its own funny, and it's just about evolving and not becoming a dinosaur, you know, which he
very
did,
much,
you know.
Very much so. The amount of comedians he knew that were really modern was extraordinary. He just had a
it's
comedy
because he
brain.
embraced them, and he gave probably the most generous thing he gave was his laughter to young comics. And they would tell him a joke, which he had probably written. and he would give them the biggest laugh, and you'd walk away from meeting him and thinking, you know, I'm on my way. You know, I'm because he knew what that meant, you know. And he, funny enough, he used to write for Eric and Ernie with John Junkin.
He did, yeah. And Les Dawson and Ken Dodd, he wrote for, and Frankie Howard. And
well, any show in any night entertainment in the 70s, you see run a roll down Rodden. At the end of the credits, and you'd always be there. And Ali Bongo.
Yeah.
Magic Advisor.
Yeah. We used to go and see him all the time, him and Ronnie Golden, who's done the podcast as well. We used to go and see both of them at Edinburgh. And when my dad sadly passed away in 2013, he died in the April, and I met Barry Cryer in the August. I've never had a picture with him, but I met him, and I said, when my dad sadly passed away, I was the last person to see him, and ran in and held his hand, and all I got out of him was, "Tell me the joke," and it was a Barry Cryer joke. And Barry Cryer looked at me, and he grinned, and he shook my hand, and he went, "I'm so sorry about your father's passing, but I'm so glad my jokes travel." And I've never forgotten that. And when I interviewed him, I said to him, I said, "It's such an honor to have you on here. I'm such a big fan of yours." And he kept saying, "Oh, you're the one." And he just kept throwing in. It was wonderful to the
never
end.
Off.
And that's a wonderful answer. I'm so pleased you knew him. Yeah. How have you found any online gigs as opposed to live
Don't
shows?
do them.
Have you done any of them?
No.
You just think it just wouldn't work?
No, in the same way that it's very difficult to film stand-up or put it on television.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah.
about being in the room at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, when it started, I just kept thinking of that attempt that had happened in Live Aid to try and do stuff between New York and London.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. Any
Work.
gap. And I know people needed to make money, and I know that people were very generous in paying to watch online, but I had no interest in watching or promoting. And, you know,
it
I
was,
just think it's a different animal, and if you're going to do it, you do it differently, you know.
It was very interesting because certainly during lockdown, it was better than nothing, should we say. But when they first started doing them, I used to go to Sean James' Happy Mondays gig online. I used to go to Always Be Comedy online, and I used to go to Charlotte Regan's Irishman Abroad.
It was you then?
So it was me sitting there. But at the start of it, there was no audio. So I used to sit here and laugh like a drain, but they couldn't hear me. And I thought I was going to, the people banging on the walls, I thought I was going to be taken away. But when they brought the audio in, they could time the jokes, they could chat to the audience, but it wasn't live. Thank God it came back, because there's nothing better than to meet up with a few friends, go have something to eat, and then have a few beers and sit in a live audience and just think, right, entertain me, because it's of the moment, as you say. When the comedians walk on, anything can happen. And that's extraordinary. That's the magic of it. It really.
Well, that's the same as being in a. It's why you go and watch live sport with a lot of people, you know. It's a communal event. It's something that is a shared experience, which is the line that is always used with theatre. That's what makes it different from this, you know, flat screens and.
Yeah.
And there's an immediate distance. I mean, I have something I tell acts off for a lot when they're starting out is reading. You know, unless it's bringing anything to the gag, the moment you do that, we've lost your face.
Yeah.
You know, and the focus isn't there. And it's about contact. It's about sharing, you know.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. As soon as they start doing that with notes on their hands, it's like, learn it. It needs to be spontaneous, you know. But anyway, it's all experience. I've been watching stand-up comedy for most of my life. How do you think comedy has evolved over the last 50 years? Big question.
I don't. The shows have evolved since when we started. I mean, when, as you probably remember, in the late 70s, early 80s, there were a smattering of clubs and a smattering of gigs. You know, there wasn't much work. People were coming off working with Covent Garden street acts. People were coming from music and folk. It was a real mishmash. And an early bill at the King's Head would not offer more than two comics on the bill. You'd have a special act, which might be something like Earl Oaken, or it might be a juggler off the street or whatever. And we'd certainly have a straight music act, and our audience would quite happily listen to 15, 20 minutes of good music, you know, and not say, where's my laugh?
Yeah.
And I think that the shows changed as Time Out and City Limits changed their listing from alternative cabaret to comedy. Then the onus for a punter was, I'm going to a comedy night.
Yeah.
And so you would now get bills that were much more just pure comedy focused. I mean, I remember I helped set up, helped Richard set up Kilkenny Cats Laughs Festival. And he was interested in, Richard Cook, this was, and he was really interested in comedy as a very pure form of theatrical storytelling. He didn't like prop acts, music acts. He just liked one person telling stories, you know, as a very pure form of theatre, which must go right back to cave days, you know.
Yeah.
And making it humorous how Ugg got killed by the mammoth, you know. But so I don't think comedy changes, but I think the context in which it operates does. So, you know, right in the 50s, you'd be part of a big bill on a variety, and you'd have front cloth acts and hierarchy. Now that's been replicated in a lot of clubs now. So you'll get people who are lower down the bill. They might not start the show though. They might be in the middle of the show. And that might be a safer place to put them. I still operate on the basis that everybody gets the same money, everybody gets the same time, and they've all got to be there. You know, I don't gradate anybody's pay. Everybody gets the same. Even on the, if you're Joe Brand next to Richard Gill's first gig, if you're, you know, you will get the same money. And that's the old sort of, that's a legacy of the old socialist side of this circuit, you know.
Good man.
So the clubs have changed, and I think, you know, we've watched the Americans. That's informed the style a bit. I think we're now entering another phase, which is bespoke comedy for bespoke audiences. People who are, you know, would really struggle on a tough Tuesday night in Romford and wouldn't, you know, enjoy being at the end of that audience, but can also fill out 100 seats on a Tuesday night somewhere else, doing their own thing to their own friends.
Yeah.
But I think part of the job of a good, you know, you don't really want a builder who says, "Oh, well, I can only do that sort of wall." You know, I think you want a comic who can actually turn up and read the room. And you're saying about, you know, being in a room with you know, the feel of a room with a good show happening.
Yeah.
I mean, every one of those comics, if they're, you know, working regularly, will probably at any one time be doing the same set at that time in their lives. So on Tuesday, they'll do basically the same set as they'll do on Thursday, if it's a 20-minute slot. But the audience and the feel and the ambience will be different. The speed at which you do the thing, even though using the same words. Now, a good comic will make that work. And that's where the Americans are very good. They can make it look as though it's fresh each time. The English, you can see the dead eyes behind going, oh God, I've done this. But, you, but then, you know, there are other acts like Otis Cannelloni who, you know the joke that's coming and it still works.
Yeah.
And that's Tommy Cooper. So those are the same techniques, just being used differently. So I don't think comedy itself has changed. It's still funny watching Ugg being eaten by the mammoth. But we've just, I still think one of the, apparently Groucho Marx was once asked, what's the difference between an amateur and a professional comedian? And he said, well, an amateur comic thinks it's funny to get dressed up as an old lady and sit in a wheelchair at the top of a steep hill and have the brakes let off and career down and hit a brick wall at the bottom. But he said, but a professional comedian would only settle for a real old lady.
That's brilliant.
Which is
brilliant and true.
So that, nothing's changed there.
That's wonderful. I like the infamous Ken Dodd story about he's describing laughter when he tells a joke and he's got laughter and he describes it coming up through his body and out through his mouth, and it's a big elongated way of describing it. And he said Freud said laughter was this and did it all, and this great long sentence. And was getting laughs. And at the end of it, the tagline was, mind you, ladies and gentlemen, Freud never played Glasgow Empire on a Friday night. And I think that says it all. You know, I think you're right. I think if you're funny, if you're a comic, and you're good at what you do, then it will forever carry on. It's just, as you say, the comedy clubs, I think, have changed. My first ever bill when I first came down to London, I went to the Comedy Store, I went to Jongleurs, and I went to downstairs the King's Head because I lived in Stoke Newington. The Comedy Store bill had Steve Gribbin, Richard Morton, Phil Jupitus, and Linda Smith, God bless her. And all those sorts of comedians then are still evolving now. They're just in obviously different form, but it's the same sort of delivery, the same sort of topper of a joke. You know, it's all this similar thing, and I think that's why comedy evolves. But I think where they actually perform it, there's an argument about playing in arenas, there's an argument about playing in comedy clubs, doing 5-minute spots, like you said. It's fascinating, and I've seen them all everywhere. I remember when I first saw Peter Kay in Manchester, he was on a bill of 5 acts and he was in a little tiny club. And he was so funny. I said to my friend, this guy's going to be a superstar. He was so funny. I was still laughing at when the 5th act came on. And about 6 months later, I had to go up to Dave Gorman and apologize because I was laughing less than it said. And, you know, it's those memories that create.
Yeah, some people arrive fully formed, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember seeing Mark Lamar when he was quite young at the downstairs, and he hadn't got any material, but he was just so watchable, you know.
Yeah.
It's partly playing the room, it's partly wanting to watch it. That's one of the things I look for on the Thursdays, is much less listening to material as watching how people work the room.
And
whether they have a sort of comic sensibility and a comic rhythm, and audiences feel comfortable with that. They spot it as well, you know.
Very much so. I am going to ask you what you think is the hardest question probably of this interview. Do you have any particular favourite comedians, past and present?
As such, I mean, as you asked earlier, there's lots of times I remember, you know, great nights and great comics, but that can happen to anybody, any time. I have to say, because they were taken too soon, you know, Jeremy Hardy, Sean Locke. And, you know, Sean Hughes, who went recently as well. One thing each of them shared was the fact they didn't share anything. They were originals. And you know, watching Andrew Bailey or somebody like that doing Podomovsky, which when it worked was just the most extraordinary. Or Chris Lynham. You know, I quite like the chaos of stuff that just happens. But at the same time, I love watching people who have great thought and construction gone into their comedy. You know, people like Emo Phillips, who can just,
Oh, superb.
You know, just turn, or Steve Wright, you know, that, you know, that sort of great skilled writing and time. So basically the answer is anybody and everybody except some.
Yeah. Yes. And following on from that, like me, did you or do you go to a lot of comedy gigs as a member of the audience?
No, not really. It's a bit of a busman's holiday, and I mean, I've helped out with, you know, running charity shows at the Palladium or something like that, you know, running the show. But, you know, I see these people in and out socially, you know, in the sound room, or the green room of the King's Head, and a lot of people say, "Oh, I'll send you a video to get me booked," or "Come and see me." I live out of town for a start, you know, as you do. I mean, I live out towards Cambridge. I don't want to watch bloody comedy. I hate the fucking
Well, you've got a life as well outside of it, haven't you?
I have actually. I mean, I do other things, you know. You're doing me on comedy, and I'm known for the comedy at the King's Head. But, you know, I was... And still very occasionally do music composition.
Yeah, that's great.
And for years I was, you know, working as a jobbing musician, you know, touring and stuff.
That's brilliant.
So the King's Head has always been rather like my UB40, you know, when I haven't got any other work, I've had that. But I've always, you know, I've always been there every week, unless, you know, we the only week we shut is between Christmas and New Year, we're always running.
Listen, my friend, it's an extraordinary legacy, the club, and thank you so much for talking to me. It's been a wonderful, wonderful chat, and I'm looking forward to coming to the club again very, very soon.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to the cheque arriving that you promised earlier.
Well, if only I could. All the best to you, and thank you so much.
Love to all. Cheer up.
Thanks now. Bye-bye.